So tonight's class is about anonymity. We'll talk about the internet. So I'm going to grab my notes for a second. So we're going to talk about the internet as part of this, but not exclusively. I just kind of want to discuss it first. The role anonymity plays in the Torah, okay? And especially throughout Bereishis, we see a lot of stories in which anonymity plays a very key role. So what are some examples that you can offhand come up with? Where someone being anonymous or hiding their identity plays an important role.
Malachim with Abraham.
Okay, so Malachim is good, okay. Yitzchak in this week's Parsha, right? Yaakov pretends to be Esav. Alright, what else?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a difference between anonymity and deception.
Yeah, right.
Okay, good. So, there is someone being anonymous or someone pretending to be someone else.
Two
right?
Different things, right?
Right. Or pretending or allowing someone to believe that they are someone else without explicitly telling them that. Or just not telling someone the whole story. Right? So, for example, we'll get into Yosef. Right? Yosef, when his brothers come and greet him, find him, right? He doesn't necessarily lie to them. Right? He doesn't tell them, "I'm not Yosef." He really is the person he's pretending. He really is the second most powerful person in Egypt. He's just kind of leaving out the fact that he's also their brother, right? So he's not really lying to them, but he is using, to a certain extent, a form of anonymity to bring his point home. So what we're gonna do is this: we're gonna go through different cases in the Torah where anonymity is used. Or different forms of anonymity are used. And then as part of that, we're going to kind of discuss how it relates to the internet, because I think we'll see some interesting ways in which it relates to the internet as well. Okay? Okay. So let's start here with source number one. A bad feed. Hello. That was a bad feed. Sorry. Okay. So, who wants to read source number one?
A man discovered him, Yosef, and behold, he was plundering the field. The man asked him, saying, "What do you seek?" And he said, "My brothers do I seek. Tell me, please, where they are pasturing."
Okay. So, we have a this story in Bereishis. So this is Yosef. That Yosef is looking for his brothers. Yaakov sends Yosef to go find his brothers. And they're looking for his brothers, and he can't find them. So he comes upon some anonymous person, right? Who Yosef simply asks him, "Do you know where my brothers are?" And he said, "Yes." And that's it. That's the story. So this person doesn't get a name. He's just the man. But he's the man who plays a very central role in the story, because without this guy, nothing takes place, right?
Right.
If this guy doesn't tell Yosef where his brothers are, then nothing happens. So we see that sometimes we have the hidden characters in the Torah. And in source number two is the same thing, that Boaz, meanwhile, had gone up to the gate and sat down there. Just then the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken passed by. He said, "Come over, sit down here, Ploni Almoni." Right? This is the famous example of the hidden character. His name is literally Ploni Almoni, and this is a big discussion in the commentaries as to why his name is intentionally kept out of the text. Right? I mean, this is literally John Doe. Right? Ploni Almoni is the John Doe. So there we get into the reason that he's not mentioned by name is because he did something wrong. He passed up the opportunity to help Ruth by redeeming her, so therefore he becomes Ploni Almoni. And this type of the hidden character, the anonymous character, they're not really anonymous. The Torah is making them anonymous. Okay, so here's kind of one example. Yeah.
But the Torah doesn't hesitate to name people who did wrong things.
You're right. So this is almost like a literary device. It almost begs the question, why is this person suddenly anonymous? Right? We had it in last week's Parsha. In last week's Parsha, Eliezer is asked by Yitzchak to find a wife for Yitzchak. The only problem is it never says Eliezer's name in the entire Parsha. It calls him the man, it calls him the slave. It never says his name. So he becomes the anonymous character of the Parsha. So it's almost a literary tool to a certain extent, because I wrote about this last week, that I think part of the message is Eliezer, his role changes from Eved to Ish. That when he's with Avram and when he's with Yitzchak, he is the Eved, he is their slave, he's the servant. And then when he is with, and then when he's on his own trying to figure out who's out there, to find a wife for Yitzchak, so he becomes the Ish. He's now making his own decisions. That's almost like a literary tool. Sorry?
He's not totally anonymous in the Torah. He is named.
But in this Parsha, he's not named. Because the whole Parsha without naming him. So I think there's kind of a literary device there. It's a bit of a literary device.
Maybe because maybe it's not relevant, I mean, to the story, the point that the story wants to tell. It's not relevant about who the messenger is. Or who,
so it could be, yeah. So it could be irrelevant, or it could be a message.
Why would they?
Right. So I think the first source here you could argue is more irrelevant. Who needs to know? I think the second source of the Ploni Almoni is much more intentional. I think with Eliezer could be much more intentional. But like Bella was saying, there's a lot of people in the Torah who we get their names, but they're not so relevant to the entirety of the story. Although you're right. I mean, there's a mixed bag. Sometimes they'll say, and sometimes they won't. But that's one type of anonymity. But that's not, we're not going to focus on that so much. I just kind of wanted to give all the different types.
I know that Eliezer gets a lot of attention because there's a chart in the back of an art scroll, Chumash Mahadurat Yafe, where it compares the two versions of the story, if memory serves. In other words, what the Torah says Eliezer did with Rivka and how he relates the story later.
Right. In the discrepancies.
So, in other words, he gets a lot of attention.
Oh, for sure. Oh, he is, in many ways, the central figure of the entire story, the entire Parsha. Right? Without, you know, he's the decision maker, he's the doer, he's the active one. Avram is somewhat passive in that story, and so is Yitzchak. So it's really Eliezer and then Rivka become the central characters, right? And yet, it never says his name. So to me, that's intentional, right? If it's like this person in the first source, the guy who tells Yosef where his brothers are, so okay, it says his name, it doesn't seem to matter all that much. But to not mention Eliezer's name when he's a central figure, that seems to be relevant, right? So sometimes the Torah will leave out the name, I think, for a specific purpose.
Does anybody ever suggest why this was done?
For which case? Eliezer?
Yeah.
So that's what I was saying. I think it's teaching us that the different roles that he plays. That within the same story, he switches from a servant to an independent person. Right? Because it changes his descriptions from Eved to Ish, to man. So I think that's a very relevant function. If he's just Eliezer, then he's always the same person. But it shows that the difficulty of Eliezer's role was, in one sense, he was trying to fulfill Avram's wishes, but in the other sense, he had to do it in his own, he had to make his own decisions, right? His goal is go find the wife for Yitzchak. It's a very vague goal that requires...
He set up the requirements.
Right. So, you know, it's one thing if your employer says, all right, here's your task and here's how you're going to do it.
Which is very interesting also. I mean, why didn't Abraham say, Abraham gave him a tremendous amount of trust.
Right, tremendous amount of trust.
You know, do your thing. And right. Then Eliezer does, you know, he lists what he's looking for in a person. And then he finds Rivka. But it's so that in itself is very interesting.
Yeah, it's almost as if Abraham realizes the only way this will work is if I give him full trust to make a decision. Because if he's trying so hard to do what I want, it's almost impossible at some point, right? Meaning, if you're spending your time trying to predict what Avram would do, so you're gonna fail, because you can't really do that. You're not Abraham. So ultimately, you have to attack the situation the way you would attack it. And I think Avram realizes that to be effective here, he's got to give Eliezer that freedom. So it's
an interesting thing, because he's acting as a surrogate for Avraham, mm-hmm. and therefore he's anonymous, because he's, in a way, he's doing his own thing, and in a way, he's not.
Right. Exactly. So it's like an employee who's given a task. You know, you're given direction, and they then have to, within that direction, figure out for themselves. I know Malcolm Gladwell talks about one of his books about effective military leadership, and there's this guy who's a really effective general, and what he did was he would give a tremendous amount of trust to the people working under him, that he felt his role was to present a general mission and kind of a modus operandi, but then not to micromanage them, to allow them to work. You find good people, you help them see and understand the mission, and then you trust them. Because if they're always coming back to you for every little thing, and if they're always second-guessing themselves, is this what the leader would really want? You're handcuffing them so much, they can't really even do the job. So it's almost a lesson in leadership by Abraham. Yeah, sorry?
I wanted to say that there's an analogy in the world of copyright. There's a concept of a work done for hire. Let's say, you know, you're an engineer and you're asked to write a manual for a certain piece of equipment. That's considered a work done for hire, and you don't own the copyright. You don't even have to be named. You're paid right. to do the work, and the company owns the copyright.
Right, it's like you're writing a translation, you're writing a textbook or something, right? Exactly, right. So, right, that's a good point. Okay. So 3 and 4 I kind of lumped together. I think they're similar. First, we have the story of Yosef, as we talked about. Source number 3, Yosef saw his brothers and he recognized them, and he acted like a stranger toward them and spoke with them harshly. Yosef recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Okay, so like we said, Yosef doesn't really lie to them per se. He, you know, at times maybe he lies to them a little bit by implying he doesn't know who they are. Obviously he knows who they are, and obviously he knows their backstory. When he asks them, how many brothers do you have, he knows the answer. But Yosef determines that he needs to remain anonymous. And then also with Tamar, I think it's similar as well. Tamar maybe is a little bit more deceptive. And Tamar was told as follows, "Behold, your father-in-law is coming up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she removed her widow's garb from upon her, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself up. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot, since she had covered her face." So Tamar had married Judah's two older sons, and they both died without her having any children. And the youngest son was too young to marry, and she felt that Judah kind of was ignoring her. So what she does is she decides to pretend to be a harlot. Judah then sleeps with her, impregnates her, and they have a child together. So Tamar also never says, "I'm not Tamar." She never says that. She doesn't pretend to be someone else intentionally. She just hides her real identity. So I think that's kind of why I lumped them together, that this is intentional use of anonymity, but you're not impersonating somebody else.
Would that be considered deception in both cases?
I think there's a level of deception here, for sure. Right? I think there's a level of deception. They're certainly using a form of anonymity, but they're not impersonating. Right?
I wanted to go back to Cersei. I think that's totally different from the case of Tamar. I think that what Yosef was doing was like increasing the drama. That it was, you know, so amazing to him to recognize his brothers. I don't know, he was like teasing them, and that he was overwhelmed also.
Well, I think what's happening here is, I think, certainly, let's take the case of Yosef, let's talk about it, because I think this is using anonymity for good. Okay, and there are definitely times when the internet anonymity is a very important tool. So how is Yosef using anonymity for good here? So, okay, let's play out the situation. Let's say Yosef tells them the moment he sees them, "Hey, it's me, Yosef." Okay? Now, what happens going forward? What's his relationship with his brothers going to be?
I don't think that he may not have, whatever I've read about this, one of the things is that Yosef wanted to find out who these, where are they coming from. I mean, he didn't leave in a very good situation.
Right.
I mean, these guys wanted to kill him. So here they are standing before him. What do you do with a guy who wanted to kill you? How do you respond to them? You're not going to rush out and say, "Hey, I'm still alive." You have to think this over. It was a shock to him, and he had to maybe absorb this thing and figure out where are they at this point. Do they still want to kill him?
Right. So, okay. So part of it is Yosef.
You could say,
look, Yosef had the option. He could have given them the food, sent them on their way, never to be seen again.
Right.
Right? Yosef has that option. They obviously don't know who he is.
Right.
He could do that.
Right.
So it seems though Yosef does want to have a relationship with them again. So there's two ways of looking at it. One way is kind of what you're saying is, well, Yosef has to decide if he wants to have a relationship with them. And he's not sure yet. Let's see if they're the same, right? If they're the same people, then what's the point? Why put myself through that? What's the point? Another way of looking at it is he wants to allow the brothers a chance to do tshuva. Okay? Because if Yosef tells them right from the get-go, "I am your brother," they can never really do tshuva. Because as the Rambam says, what's tshuva gemur? What's real tshuva? It's when you're put in the same situation, you act differently. If you're not put in the same situation, you can't really say definitively how you would behave. And for the brothers themselves, if Yosef tells them, "I'm your brother," then they'll never really think that Yosef forgives them. Because they can never demonstrate that they've changed. Because once Yosef says, "I'm Yosef," now everything is in the specter of Yosef and his brothers.
But
right?
How is this the same situation?
As what?
I don't know. I to relate to the Rambam's point. How is the situation of Yosef in Egypt...
Similar to the Rambam?
Similar to the previous incident with the brothers...
Because the whole point of the story is to force them to be in a situation where they have to decide what to do with Binyamin. When it comes down to their jealousy for Binyamin versus their own necks, what will they choose? Right? That's the whole test. The whole test is about Binyamin, because Binyamin is the facsimile of Yosef. Right? He is Rachel's other child. He clearly is still the child that Yaakov is favoring, and we see how hard it is for Yaakov to give him up. And the truth is, there's a little bit of a lesson here for Yaakov. You've got to let go a little bit. Right? He couldn't let go of Yosef, and he couldn't let go of Binyamin. So there's a little bit of a lesson for Yaakov, whether it's intentional or not. But the real test is when the brothers are put down to that test again. You have to assume they're jealous of Binyamin too.
But they'll stick up. The circumstances are different. Binyamin had 10 children at the time of the story. When they went down to Egypt, he had 10 children.
Well, he's certainly older.
He wasn't a kid.
He was,
and Yosef was a kid,
right?
And
right.
It's
definitely not an exact facsimile, for sure. There's no way. There's no way to completely. You can't redo everything, the entirety of the case. But we see from Yaakov's behavior and treatment of Binyamin, in some ways, Yaakov treats Binyamin like a child.
Yeah.
Right. You can't take this boy away. You can't take him away from me.
Right.
He's not treating him like an adult. He treats him like a child. So, in that sense, Yaakov's relationship to Binyamin is not much different than Yaakov's relationship to Yosef. Now, Yosef doesn't know this for a fact. He hasn't seen Yaakov and Binyamin interact, but he's assuming this. And when he forces Binyamin to come, and when he frames Binyamin for stealing, and when he says, "Hey, just leave Binyamin here, you guys can go back home." And when the brothers say, "No, we can't do that," then they've demonstrated that they've changed. They've demonstrated to Yosef, and they've demonstrated to themselves. So now when Yosef says, you know, I am Yosef, is my father alive? The brothers can now take a deep breath a little bit, because they know that they've showed Yosef we're different now. Now, you should feel free to have a relationship with us again, right? Because they've shown it, but they've shown it in a way that there's no pressure on them, right? Yosef's anonymous. So Yosef's anonymity is key for them to do tshuva. Because if there's no anonymity, the assumption will be, well, you're only doing this because you're trying to impress Yosef. The fact that he's anonymous allows the situation to occur. So it's really his anonymity that's the key to the story, right? It's a key point for the whole thing to work. So, and I think this gets into, you know, some of the anonymity of the internet is very positive. We'll see all sorts of situations where you have whistleblowers, you have people who are kind of free to be more honest, to express themselves. In some ways, a lot more accurate information can get out with anonymity. And you'll see all the time the use of anonymous sources in all sorts of articles, right? I mean, think about Woodward and Bernstein, right? Woodward and Bernstein, you know, right? Watergate is not uncovered if not for Deep Throat, and not just Deep Throat. He's the most famous example, but there's other anonymous sources along the way. Without the anonymity, nothing happens there, right? I mean, it's much more difficult for them to uncover the case.
Well, how does whistleblowing relate to the concept of being a moser?
Oh, that's a whole other... A moser? Okay, that's a different... That's a whole other class. We'd have to get into what a moser is and what it's not. Yeah, it's a good question. I just... That's another... I mean, they're not supposed to hand over a Jew to the secular authorities, you know, because of you're supposed to handle things in house. That's a whole other conversation. So, and we've also seen, especially in certain countries where information is suppressed, and anonymity is a very key tool to keep people safe and to be able to get out information. We see this on Twitter all the time that. The dictatorial regimes are having a much harder time today than ever at controlling information coming out from the countries, and that's affecting their ability to, you know, manage countries in this way. So there's a real positive to it, and I think we see it in Tamar as well, right? Tamar is effective because she's anonymous. If she is not anonymous, then this doesn't work either. So we see that in anonymity in the Torah can have very positive consequences. There's also something called there's an alternate persona, and this is an interesting concept, is that I was speaking to someone I know who worked at Twitter, and he works in the internet world, and he says that, I asked him, are people getting more or less anonymous on the internet over time, right? And the answer is, over time, people are getting less anonymous, right? Because it's not that satisfying to be completely anonymous, because then you're not getting any credit and you're not developing relationships. And ultimately, we don't want to be too anonymous for long. Even serial killers, right? They catch serial killers because the serial killers start to give away clues because they get frustrated that no one knows it's them, right? It becomes a very hard... they get very frustrated and they end up tripping up. They have calling cards, they have nicknames, they start to give away clues, because in some way they want to get caught, because they want everyone to know what they're doing, right? It's hard to be anonymous. It's frustrating. So, but what happens on the internet a lot is that while people, they're not anonymous, but they develop kind of separate personas, right? And you have a lot of people who develop screen names, they develop anonymous blogs, they do all sorts of different things where they're anonymous, but they're not anonymous. You can kind of you can release parts of your personality that you might not feel comfortable releasing to, you know, in a person-to-person encounter, but maybe parts of your sense of humor, maybe discussing things a certain way. So you'll have screen names, and you'll have blogs, and you'll have names you use for in chat rooms and in message boards to comment. So you have a persona. You're anonymous, but you're not anonymous. So it's an interesting concept. I was just reading about something like this. What was the case? Right, so then we have like these internet celebrities that develop, right? These kind of separate personas over time. You've got this like meme phenomenon where people are trying to like do similar things on the internet and top each other. So there's kind of this interesting little game. You have like Twitter accounts. So it's not, a lot of people create phony Twitter accounts where they never reveal who they are. So for example, after Clint Eastwood's speech where he was talking to the chair, right? So somebody created a Twitter account called Invisible Obama. And they just wrote this, they would just write on Twitter as if they are Invisible Obama. It was like a funny site, it got like 100,000 followers in like a few hours. But no one knew who this person was. They never revealed who they were, they never said their name, it's totally anonymous. But it's a persona of theirs now. It's like something they own.
The concept of anonymity is a powerful tool. It's very powerful because you can get away with things and you don't have to expose yourself. And you can show a side, as you said, that you would never show.
Right.
But it's what happens is I think the message becomes the straw, what they're saying, rather than
who they are.
So
right.
It's in all these cases, it's what they're doing and what they're saying that is the important thing.
Right.
They're removed from the thing.
Oh, it's a good way. It's a good way of putting it. But because once they know it's Yosef, now the water has been poisoned a little bit. Right.
It changes
the equation.
Changes.
Right. And then Tamar too. If she says, "Hi, I'm Tamar, will you marry me, Yehuda?"
You're going to kill this woman. It's a daughter.
Right. But when she's anonymous, right, now it's about the act itself.
Right.
Right. So it removes all the baggage.
It removes all the... And it would be right. The same thing on the internet. These people can say, and it's the message, what they're saying, which is right. What's important.
Right. Now, the flip side is, if nobody knows who you are, it's hard to gain credibility. Right? If you're a famous pundit or something, and then you're making a statement, people are going to listen. If you're just a random anonymous person, it's hard to be taken very seriously unless you can really cultivate some sort of persona. So you're limited.
Is that true?
Yeah, you're limited. You're limited in the world of anonymity. You're limited in how far. Meaning, you can be funny because funny is funny.
Right.
You can be interesting, but it's hard to get a lot of credibility unless you claim to be. You know, you'll have blogs where, you know, I am really, an insider in Hollywood, but I can't say who I am, but I'll tell everyone's secrets. So then it just depends how much people believe that you're really an insider in Hollywood. If you really are, and people really believe it because you can kind of prove it, then the fact you're anonymous is okay because people view you as you're now an anonymous source. That's people like that, but you've got to be able to get credibility. But in general, if you're not putting your name on and people don't know you are, it's a little hard to gain credibility, I think, in general. Yeah?
Well, I wanted to say that the concept of screen name is not new because there have been pseudonyms in literature
sure.
for ages.
Right, Hollywood,
and
sure.
And that's exactly right. The same.
Right, no, for sure. Right, and...
Right, exactly.
Right, and I mean, I guess in some ways they were personas to a certain extent. Certainly in Hollywood,
right.
Yeah. I mean, like Rodney Dangerfield is a persona. It's not really him. It's kind of a play on a personality.
That's not his real name?
No, it's not his real name. It's like Sam.
Really?
So it's a Jewish name, very Jewish name. Yeah, Dangerfield. No, it's a stage name. It's a comedy name.
But let me tell you about multiple personas, you know, I teach cataloging, and it used to be, you know, there was a debate in the literature if an author uses a pseudonym and you know his real name, which should be the heading in the catalog.
Uh-huh.
But recently they came up with the idea of separate bibliographic identities, and the classic example is Lewis Carroll,
uh-huh.
who was a logician, and uh-huh. his real name was Charles Dodgson. So the idea is, even though he's one person, you catalog his logic books under his real
name. That's interesting.
And his
so he really had two different personas,
exactly.
Two different writing styles for two different names.
Exactly.
Right, there you go. That's a good point. Right.
Yeah.
So that's exactly, it's the same thing, right? They're creating a persona to be a certain type of person.
What if someone goes, I don't indulge in these things, so I don't know, but if someone is anonymous and they have a message, whatever it is, if it's a comedy or something, and they keep doing it. Do they eventually develop a persona and an identity of, because of the message, and it does get across because the people have been reading what they've been saying?
Sure.
For a long time.
It definitely could. If it gets really famous, then they might come out and
then
say who they are.
The anonymity becomes in itself.
Let me tell you an example. Yeah. So I have a colleague who used to teach children's literature, and besides teaching, she used to write romance novels under a pseudonym, Shannon Blair. But then she became successful. So she started to use her real name in writing children's literature.
Right, because it is.
But she also, what I'm trying to say, is the name Sharon Blair became
Shannon
something in and of itself.
Yeah.
It didn't matter what, and people would read her because they knew her this.
Right.
They knew her as that name.
Right.
So
that she was writing a formula for a series, but then she started to write original children's literature under her own name.
It's interesting because she wanted to be identified not as that
formula fiction writer.
Right.
They would have, like in Atari, you did also, because when they reveal who they are, then the dynamic does change and they become...
Right, that's true. Well, and there's the bad side to this is you have many people who pretend... Who become anonymous in order to have some sort of personal gain, right? Or they create dummy accounts. That's very common. That on Twitter, for example, there's a lot of fake accounts. Anyone can create an account. So you can create an account, and people will pay you to follow them because it boosts their numbers, right? There's all sorts of things like that go on, like artificial boosting of numbers, because the more people that follow you on Twitter, the more impressive you look. But if a lot of the accounts are fake, but they're just kind of like boosting up numbers artificially, so that happens a lot. Employers.
Talk about a Jewish source. I heard that on J-Date, people arrange for others to label them as hot.
Exactly. Right. That your people are. Falsely trying to create a perception that they are more impressive than they are. Exactly,
yeah.
Right.
There's a mystery writer, I guess, Julie Smith, I'm a mystery fan. She, one of her mysteries is about this these computer people who create a town. The website is called Our Town, and all these people are anonymous, and they have a whole life going within this anonymity.
Right.
They create situations, and they don't know who these people really are.
Well, you have,
They don't know each other.
Anonymous. Well, online you have games like Sims and other games where people create avatars, and they are Second Life, I think it's called, and they have characters that's their avatar, but they're always the same person, and they develop relationships online with these people, with other people. And they don't really know who the other one is. They're also avatars. And they develop long-term relationships. There's actually been some cases of spouses that have gotten divorced because, your avatar had an affair with someone else's avatar and they got jealous. Really, I mean, this really has happened.
That's a very interesting thing.
Yeah, it's a really interesting... So the other spouse saw this as a form of adultery, that you're cheating on. I'm not really cheating on you. Well, why are you doing this? Why are you developing this relationship online with this other person? Obviously, there's something missing, So, yeah, you have got this whole communities that develop out of anonymity. Yeah, it's a very interesting concept. Even employers do this now. I mean, employers sometimes will create fake Facebook accounts or things like that so they can follow what their employees are doing.
Really?
Sure. Or they'll have one employee set up an account, but really it's the employer who's managing it, and they're kind of watching what's happening because it's the way they can track their movements and behaviors and all sorts of things in more sinister ways. So there's all sorts of things that are happening now on the internet that allow for misuse of anonymity in those different ways. It's interesting.
I remember a couple of years ago I had a consulting job for a database company, and the first screen said, there's no privacy here.
Right.
This is the company's computer, and we can read all your email.
Right, so and now we'll get to the Petraeus case in a minute.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So the Betrayus case, I think, is interesting. Do I want to talk about it now, or will? We'll hold off on the Betrayus case. We'll go through more sources, then we'll get to it. I want to develop this a little more. So sources 5 and 6 are a little bit different than 3 and 4. So 3 and 4 are people kind of creating, or, you know, alternate personas. 3 and 5 and 6 are where you're really pretending to be someone else, right? So first source number 5, so Rebecca then took her older son Esau's clean garments, which were with her in the house, and clothed Yaakov, her young son, with the skins of the he-goats, of the goat kids, and she covered his arms in his smooth skin neck. So Yaakov impersonates Esau. That's different already. Now he's intentionally trying to pretend to be another person, a known person. And Laban does the same thing, right? So Laban, source number 6, so Laban gathered all the people of the place and made a feast, and it was evening that he took Leah's daughter and brought her to him, and he consorted with her, and Laban gave Zilpah his maidservant, a maidservant to his daughter Leah, and in the morning, and it was, and behold, it was Leah. So, here we have, right, that Leah pretends to be Rachel, right? So it's a real impersonation. They're not just anonymous, they're impersonating somebody else. So here we have, I mean, this is fraud, right? This is very different.
Outrageous.
Yeah, this is a whole other level of fraud. Now, the first case we can more readily justify potentially because we think Yaakov's intentions are pure. Lovins, we're not going to try to justify because we don't.
Yaakov's intentions were pure. I think Yaakov was taught deception by his mother, and this was Lovins' daughter, sister, you know, and this is how they operated. I don't think it was pure.
I think she obviously felt, and I get into the story in so much depth, but she obviously felt that Yaakov was the right person to be the next leader of the Jewish people and not Esau.
Under any circumstances.
And this,
the ends,
right.
Do the means justify the end?
Do the
end justify,
and justify the means? So it depends what the ends are, it depends what the means are. Right?
You're right.
It seems that this
is... Because he was an Ish Tam before Yosef, right. Ohalim. He was innocent. I mean, he was a bit manipulative with the powers and all that.
Right.
But he had it in him. But she really brought this out in him, which he used later on in his life.
Which he needed in the end, right.
She took away his innocence.
Well, I don't, either she took it away or she was training him, because he was going to need this later in life, like you said. That to be a leader, you can't be too innocent. Meaning, you can be innocent, but you also have to be aware that not everyone else is going to be innocent. So, you want to be idealistic, but you can't be taken advantage of, or you can't be an effective leader. So there's a balance there. And it seems like maybe she felt Yaakov needed a little bit more balance. And it could have been a little good for him to have to be a little aggressive and even sneaky, it seems. But I mean, obviously, we can't get into the whole situation, but clearly she felt that this was the only way to do it. Obviously, Yitzchak wouldn't hear it, or
yeah.
it wasn't happening any other way. So, this is a whole other type of fraud. This is pretending to be somebody else. And we, you know, this is something that begins to happen on the internet too. And a lot of the downside of the internet can be situations in which people pretend to be other people, or anonymity that's used for bad. So, I mean, I had a situation, you know, I had a situation a few years back where there was this really horrible case. I don't know if you heard about this case, but there's a group called the Eternal Jewish Family. You hear about this case? So, there was this group that was started, got involved in conversion, okay? And the leader of the group was busted for a misuse of power, let's say, where he had the ability to decide if people could convert or not, and he was misusing that power for, you know, especially with women. And she videotaped, she taped a phone call of theirs and put it on YouTube, and it became a whole big scandal. So anyway, so all the Jewish blogs were writing about this. It became a big, big scandal. And then the entire organization just went kaput. You know, it had only been around for a couple of years. So the woman lived in Houston, right, where this was happening. So I lived in Houston for a couple of years. And then I was already in San Francisco. And the person who ran this group ran yeshiva in Muncie, where some kids who grew up in San Francisco before I got there had gone to that yeshiva. And then I come back, and they came back a lot. Sometimes they did like a summer seed program to learn with people. So somebody writes on one of these blogs in a comment that I must have somehow be involved in this situation because I lived in Houston and because our community had this connection to this yeshiva because we had guys who had gone there. And she made through this like circumstantial evidence, right, there's different connections that had no connection, I had nothing to do with anything. This happened after I left. She's like, I found out about it like weeks after it had come out. But the anonymity of the internet allows you to make all sorts of accusations. And so when you Googled my name for a year, that's like one of the first five things that showed up, right?
Wow.
You know? And now it's kind of disappeared and I kind of fought back. But like, you know, it's very easy to do things like that. So here is the danger of the internet, and it's kind of what Love One does, is you can pretend to do something that can really be harmful. Here we get into, pretending to be other people, or, now we get to a whole other level of fraud. Let's go to the next source here, and let's go to source number,
I just wanted to ask, did you get rid of it by contacting Google? I've been told to do that.
No, I just kind of commented back on the same, I just kind of re-commented back on there to kind of respond at least. I was
they
told...
They can do terrible things, this is terrible.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing you can, And, of course, the person's anonymous, you can't respond to the person, which makes it the hardest. I thought I knew who it was, I actually called them and left a message, they never called me back. I had a feeling who it was, I don't know for sure, but And I still don't know why they did it. I didn't have any problems with them. And just, you know, sometimes people are sensational or they want to throw something out there. Or they want to...
They're evil. People can be evil.
These things happen all the time. I mean, all the time.
But suspecting in the area of anonymous grant reviews and refereeing, you know, I knew a Judaica researcher who was turned down for a grant. And he suspected that he knew who had reviewed the grant and turned him down. And it created ill will. He really did not know.
Right. So he assumed it. I mean, that makes it even worse if you're assuming it. That's true. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking about the Petraeus case. And one thing stuck out to me a little bit about this situation. And... You know, you have this guy now, as we see, it's bigger. We've got the guy in the Allen from the army as well. That so, what's interesting about the internet is that, in some ways, it's the most public entity we have, and yet people feel like it's anonymous, right? And I think this is kind of one of the traps of the internet: is it feels very private, but it's in fact extremely public. And I think that's where people get into a lot of... And it tricks people. It's deceptive in that way. And these guys thought that they were being deceptive and discreet, right? And they created different... You know, so Petraeus and Broadwell, they're saying how they communicated with each other, that they didn't send emails to each other because that would leave a paper trail. So they created fake Gmail accounts, and instead of emailing to each other, they would just write a draft on the email and never send it. And then they each had each other's password, or maybe they just shared one account, I'm not sure. And the other one would go read the draft and delete it, so there was never any sent email that would leave a trace.
But why do you say they would create a paper trail by...
An electronic paper trail.
Yeah.
Right. Which is all, in the end, all the same, in this day and age.
That people just don't say, meet me at the corner at 3 o'clock and we'll talk.
So why don't they, right? So yeah, it's interesting, right?
Why don't they do that?
It's a very interesting question. Why don't they do that? So, like Tiger Woods, right?
Near my house in Pelham Parkway, there was this big mansion that supposedly Joe Bonanno's lived in, and they say that he had a public phone installed in his backyard so that his phone could not be tapped.
Couldn't be tapped, right. So it's interesting. Here you've got the head of the CIA, and you've got this big guy in the army, and they can't seem to figure out that they're not really anonymous, right? I mean, this guy, Allen, they've got like 20,000 pages of emails they're going through of evidence against him. 20,000 pages. I mean, it's crazy.
The time.
Yeah, I know. How much? Exactly. I can't believe. I mean, isn't he fighting a war? Is there a war?
Don't they work?
I know. You can imagine.
But why isn't regular email private?
It's password protected, but
everybody hacks in.
The government can get in, and it leaves a imprint on your hard drive.
You can never get rid of it.
It's on your hard drive still. So I was reading an article about the psychology of it a little bit, right? I mean, why did Tiger Woods send 10,000 text messages? He just busted himself. All it takes is one mistress to turn on you, and you're dead, right? I mean, you're leaving textual evidence, real evidence that's going to... So why are they doing this? Why is it make a phone call, call from a payphone, whatever, do something, right? Why don't they do that? Why are they so stupid? So two answers, I think. Number one is that because people fool themselves into thinking that this is anonymous, that this is private, and that's the trap here. The trap of the internet is... It feels private. So I think that it's really...
With these important people who think they're private, is there a certain amount of vanity involved? It's like crooks get caught because they think everyone is stupid and no one's going to know what they did. I mean, it's vanity, it's stupidity. But they think that they're beyond that.
Could be, to a certain extent. Yeah, it could be.
They just think that they're in this position and no one would dream of ever...
Accusing them or suspecting them, right?
But the information scientists have known this for a long time. A few years ago at an information science conference, the author of a book called Naked in Cyberspace spoke. And she said, you have an email account, everything about you is known.
Right, but people don't treat it that way. Right.
Amazing. And,
right, it's amazing. So, I thought it's a very interesting analogy for life. I thought of source number 9, how it's related to it. So, in Pirkei Avos, a very famous line in Pirkei Avos, be aware of three things and you won't come to sin. Know what is above you, an eye that sees, an ear that hears, and all your actions are recorded, right? So to me, that's kind of what the internet is, right? Yeah. Everything's being recorded, right? But what's the big mistake we make in life is we don't see Hashem, right? Since we can't see it, we're not cognizant of it. It's not our reality. We have to remind ourselves of that reality constantly, because left to our own devices, we forget, and we begin to behave in a way where even though we know intellectually that Hashem is watching us and recording everything we're doing, we stop really believing it. We stop acting accordingly, right? So, I think this is a flaw of human nature, is that if we don't see that that's the case, we begin to convince ourselves that it's really not the case, right? So I think the internet is kind of a reflection of that. That we're we convince ourselves that it's private when we intellectually know it's not. But it's hard to wrap our heads around it because it feels so private. I'm in my office, I'm in my house, right? No one can read this, it's password protected. It feels very private. And so we convince ourselves that it is, and yet we see over and over again that it's not. Others are saying, so I was reading this article about the psychology of this. So they interviewed this guy named, the CEO of AshleyMadison.com, which became famous a few years back because they wanted to buy the naming rights for MetLife Stadium where the Jets and Giants play. Mm-hmm. But they didn't let them because it's a website dedicated to helping people cheat, have affairs. That's the whole site. Okay, So they interviewed the CEO, and they figured, I guess you must be an expert on the psychology of cheating. So why do people text and write emails? I mean, it's so easy to. He said, now a lot of private eyes, what they do is they'll send an email or find a way to put a virus like adware or spyware on the laptop of the of the other spouse, the spouse that's suspected of cheating, and all they'll do is put some spyware on there and they'll get all the information they need. Because, you know, they'll be chatting with the other person, they'll be emailing, it's so easy now. Like, they used to have to hide in cars and binoculars and trace them. Now they just put something on their computer and they can find out everything, right? So why do they do this? And he said, because, you know what? Our lives are such that we don't have the patience to do it any other way. It's like, it's not worth it, right? Meaning, people don't have the patience to make a call and then call me at a payphone, and then I'll meet you there. Our lives are just so wired. We're just so used to the immediate connection. I'll text you, I'll email you. That the cheaters don't have the patience to do it any other way. And they just...
Also, you know, we're also... It's a very scary thing because we're also... We don't have real privacy anymore. And it's been done so incrementally that we don't even realize it. So that we feel comfortable. We don't. I mean, they have cameras all over the place. So you don't know. You're not even aware that you're being photographed, and yet you are aware that you're being photographed. And we accept this. I mean, people aren't rioting. Take those cameras off. You have no right to spy on me just because I'm walking in the street. And that's step by step by step. And I think the computer and the internet are one of these steps that people are used to not having privacy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're tracking everything.
And people
everything.
Know it. They're aware of it.
Everything.
Because if they're aware of it and they're still doing it, it means that they're accepting it on a certain level.
On a certain level, yeah. Meaning the internet is, companies are constantly trying to learn about us based on what we do in the internet. Political campaigns try to learn everything about, because they want to know who are the swing voters, right? So if you're a campaign and you're going to... and you're going to spend money in a certain county, in a certain person, right? If they're going to target a group of people, they want to know the individuals who they can determine are swing voters. Because they know there's no point in, you know, the 40% who will always vote Democrat, the 4% who will always vote Republican. They know there's no point spending a cent on them. Right. It's worth spending $10,000 on the one swing voter versus a cent on the others. So they're trying to find out, through the internet especially, based on what you read, based on what sites you go on, based on all, what you write on Facebook, whatever it is, on Twitter, they want to know who it's worth going after. And they're spending a lot of money on it. When you go to Duane Reade, you get one of those little cards, right? Why do they have the cards? Because they want to track what you're buying. And they can sell that information. They can do whatever other information.
Well, there's such a thing called LinkedIn. I don't know. Right. My husband tried to once push the button. I'm mistaken. We're on LinkedIn. They know every person I've ever written to, every email that I've ever sent to anybody, they have that address.
Oh, really?
They've listed it, yes. How do they know this? They're supposed to be privacy. And I didn't go. I was very upset, you know. And there's no way to get off of this LinkedIn. I have no idea.
I'm sure you close your account.
Hmm?
You can always close an account, I'm sure.
I have no account. It's just that you just push a button and all of a sudden you're on it, and they keep sending me this information about people who I once sent an email to years ago. They have all of this information.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And there is no privacy. Yeah. How do they know this?
I wanted to ask, so police, you know, the surgeon department need a search warrant. Is there something analogous when the government goes into Petraeus's email?
Oh, you're asking me from a legal perspective?
Or a policy perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I was reading about this, because this case is fascinating to me. It's crazy. So, we had this discussion this morning. Why would he get fired over an affair? That's not a fireable offense. Right. So I was reading that, no, it's not so simple. When you're in a position of high clearance, when you get really classified information, they find out, they get access to everything. They get access to your bank account because they want to know.
They know everything.
Yeah, because if suddenly you have $500,000 in your account, then they know something's up and they need to know that. They get access to your email passwords. They need to know everyone you know and everyone you spend time with.
My son has very high clearance, and they had put, when he was getting the clearance for him, they called the people who lived in the building.
Right.
and asked about him. They called his high school. I mean, they know everything.
Right, because they need to be able to track if something suspicious is happening. So if you're the head of the CIA, having an affair is a security risk. And this happened, right, because this Broadwell had all these classified documents on her computer in her house, because now you've been compromised. And, okay, maybe she's...
She may go to jail, they would say.
She will. Maybe she's innocuous, but what if she's really some spy?
Right.
Right? I mean, right? Isn't every James Bond movie centered on that kind of concept? Right. So they need to know this. If you're creating fake email accounts and having secret relationships as the head of the CIA, that's not just a fireable offense. That could be illegal in serious ways. Right. So that's why they have access to the private emails, because they have to know what's going on. Right? They have to have access to it.
So is it only for those who need clearance, or is it everybody?
I mean, I don't know if they need a search warrant to check your email.
Just by pushing a button. Right.
Who can?
LinkedIn, you know, it's some network where for business linking in, for networking.
Right. All right, let's just finish up here a little bit. So source number 8 is a very interesting source, and we'll finish with this. Actually, we'll do 2 more sources. We'll do 7 and 8. And we see this tension a little bit in source number 7. This is from the Talmud in Yoma 86b. So Rav Rumi contrasted the following verses. So it says in Tehillim 32:1, fortunate is one whose transgressions is forgiven, whose sin is concealed. So in one sense, David HaMelech is saying that it's a bracha from Hashem if your sins are not made public. Right? That's a bracha. Right, because obviously, once it's public, now you've got a whole other mess in your hands. So, we should thank Hashem that if our sins are concealed, we should thank Hashem for that. At the same time, one who conceals his sins will not succeed. It says in Proverbs and Mishlei 28:13 that one who conceals his sins will not succeed. That if you're not coming to grips with what you've done, then you're not going to really do tshuva. Sometimes the best impetus for tshuva is if you're kind of forced to account for your behavior. So the Gemara says this is not a contradiction. The latter speaks of a sin that is widely known. The former with a sin that is not widely known. Zutra, the son of Tuvia, in the name of Nachman, said, the latter refers to a sin between man and man, the former between man and God. So this becomes a discussion between the Rambam and the Ravid. See sources 10 and 11. So the Rambam says, it's a praiseworthy thing to repent and to admit one's iniquities in public, and publicize the sins you have done to others, and say to them, I sinned against John Doe and did this and this to him, but now I have repented and want to ask for forgiveness. This is only for sins against your fellow, but sins against God you do not need to publicize. So according to the Rambam, he understands this Gemara in source number 7, that if you sin against somebody else, then you should admit to it publicly. Okay, but since you and Hashem, that you don't need to do that.
That's a pretty awful thing to do, because one of the things, if you admit something publicly, you can ruin your whole life. I mean, no one knew that you did this. You did something to somebody, and you can apologize and make good on it and everything. But if you go into the marketplace and say, listen, this is what I did, you can be finished.
Right.
But so, here it says, if you did the sin publicly.
So that's the Ravid. So the Ravid, who disagrees with the Rambam and says, verse 11, if you do any sin publicly, you should ask for forgiveness and embarrass yourself publicly. If you did a sin publicly, then you need to ask for repentance publicly. Anything you do privately, even between people, so then you don't need to ask for forgiveness. So that's kind of an interesting little discussion there. The last source here is source number 8, which is a very interesting kind of cryptic Gemara. The Gemara says as follows. This is Moed Katan 17a. Rabbi Eli said, if a person is tempted to do evil, he should go to a city where he is not known, dress in black clothes, cover his head in black, and do what his heart desires so that Hashem's name will not be desecrated. It's a very interesting Gemara. And there's a very interesting machloket here between Rashi and Tosa. What does that mean? Does this mean if you're tempted, this is your advice, go ahead and sin this way? Or does it mean you shouldn't do it, but if you're going to do it, this is better than the alternative, but certainly this isn't a good thing to do. But it's interesting to see that on some level, maybe anonymity could be good, because we all have our down times, and we all have our bad days, and we all have our, times when temptation becomes too strong. And so you want to be, you know, on some level maybe be able to maintain some sort of face or do tshuva. So it's ancient Gemara that maybe this, someone understand this to mean that there is a way of doing your chait that still allows you kind of to save your dignity and then to build off of it as opposed to being ruined by it.
It's a very, 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 very liberal thing for Jewish concepts. Is this just one person or is this generally accepted
doctrine? It's a very controversial statement in the Talmud. Yeah, it's very controversial. I don't know if we take it as like a halacha, but I think there's a lesson here that there is a value in, if you're going to sin, to do it in a way that's private, there's some value there. It's not ideal, it's not what you should do. Ideally, you should try to fight it. But if you're in that situation, there is a value to that on some level. Now, that seems to be the message of this Gemara. And, you know, it's a controversial message, but it seems that in some sense anonymity has a benefit in that way.
I heard something analogous at a lower level from Rabbi Tendler about the story of the soldier and the shavuya. He said, it's not an ideal situation, but this is how you should deal with it. But the absolute shocking thing was, you know, like, let's say you're traveling, you can have different kashrut standards, different standards of dress.
Right, so anyway, this is not saying, you know, when you're on vacation, the rules don't apply anymore, right? Exactly. Well, it's not saying that. It's saying in very... But again, it doesn't just say hide. It says you wear black clothes. You cover your head in black. Part of the idea, some say, is that this is supposed to break you out of the spell. Meaning... the Yetzer Hara does not like to wait. The Yetzer Hara likes to do things now. So if you can tell your Yetzer Hara, okay, you know, we can do it here. So let's change our clothes and wear black. So we're already kind of in a bad mood and we're kind of mourning. Now we're going to go to another city. By the time you get there, odds are you'll have broken the Yetzer Hara spell.
It's like smoking. when I was smoking, and you have an urge, you get over the physical withdrawal,
right.
But the urge lasts for a while, and I kept a carton of cigarettes always in case it got too bad. But I realized that I gave myself time, and if I waited 5 minutes and I still felt that strong urge, I would smoke.
Right.
But it never happened. After a certain amount of time, I never felt the urge smoke.
Right, so you just needed to give yourself that.
Yes. So this is in that sense that if you go and you put yourself, you put mourning clothing on, you become a mourner, and you do something so radical to yourself.
Right.
By the time you reach that stage, you know.
Right. So I think that's definitely a good way of understanding this Gemara, that it's not really saying sin this way, it's saying this is a method to prevent you from sin. I think there's a lot of truth to it.